to Stumptown Trade Review. You can check us out online at stumptowntradereview@blogspot.com. And we also have a posting at Indie Trade Comic Release that shows indie trades that are being released this week. My name's Thor.
I'm Brian.
And today we are going to be reviewing Baloney and Echo.
Two incredibly different books.
Yeah, completely different.
So
let's start out with Baloney.
Okay.
And what did you think as an overall feel?
You know, overall, I was really torn about this book. On the one hand, I thought that just the physical feel of the book was so different than a regular comic book. I mean, this is a high quality production. The quality of the print, the quality of the paper is so much higher than one expects from just a regular funny book. The story, though, is just completely, I don't even know how to describe it. It's bleak, it's disturbing, it doesn't give you the ending you expect at all.
Well, I kind of disagree, because somewhere in here it says that it's
the Russian tradition.
Yeah, the Russian fatalist.
Yeah.
And so I was expecting it to be a rather bleak kind of book. And
I didn't read that until I was done with it.
Oh, really? Yeah, so I kind of knew what I was getting into when I started. But the first thing that hit me is just the smell of the pages. Did you not notice that?
Well, I think I did. I'm taking a closer whiff here, but I think it goes back to the quality of it. I mean,
yeah.
this is the difference between a book and a comic. You know, the comic is still, even though we've moved so far beyond them being a disposable thing like they were when they first came out in the 30s, they're still printed and produced in more or less the same manner, whereas this is art book quality here.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of the same smell of Sea of Red
by
Rick Remender. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you noticed that, but it's the same type of paper, and it's like a certain paper. I remember reading in the letters of Sea of Red that somebody had commented about that, and he wrote back saying that it was the type of paper that they used.
Huh.
And I absolutely love the smell. Like, as soon as I pulled it out of my bag to show one of my friends at work, he immediately noticed the smell and opened it up and whiffed it. That's the first thing that struck me, and I just absolutely love, I don't know what it is that they're doing with the paper or whatever, but I love the smell. And somehow that added to my experience of reading it.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it brought, I guess, it, you know, for you, it brought in another sense, because you always have the sense of sight, you have the sense of touch, because the paper quality is so much higher than what we're used to. Ironically, this book, you know, for the second week in a row, comes with a soundtrack.
Yeah.
So you've got an auditory sense going here. So I guess it makes sense to trigger some sort of olfactory reaction as well. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it seems like, you know, that's just one more sense triggered for you.
Did you read White Rapids, or have you? Which is the previous book by Pascal Blanchett.
I haven't. This one came completely out of, you know, just carte blanche for me.
Well, it's got a review by The Onion on the back, which to me is it's not a good thing. It makes me not want to read it. I can't stand The Onion.
A satirical newspaper reviewing a
very
far from satirical book. But no, I think overall, I mean, at first I was a little put back when we chose this book. I mean, 1695, one of the reasons why I switched entirely to a trade format is that just the cost of comics was getting out of hand.
Yeah.
And so when I look at a book and it's 1695, and then I find out it's 85 pages long, and then when I take a look at it and there's, you know, two sentences on a page, all of a sudden all the buzzes and alarms are going off in my head that, oh great, I just dropped a chunk of change on this. But this was quality. I mean, this was worth it. This is the difference between going to the store and getting an apple and going to the store and getting an organic apple. Yeah. Just the entire quality is going to be there, and you're going to spend a little bit more than what you might expect, but the quality is there, and it's a much better experience.
I found myself thinking about the story, too, over the course of the week. The story is very bleak, and I'd say there's not a lot to it, but I think it's deceptive in that I found myself with a good comic book. You're reading in between the panels, you know, you see somebody swinging a bat and then the ball connecting, and you automatically, you know, fill in the blanks between that. And I felt like because the story was so, I guess it didn't fill in a lot of the blanks for you. It left a lot for you.
I mean, for the people that haven't read it, I mean, just a quick recap. It follows a butcher in a small town. It says on the very first page, the setting a poor, isolated town on a high, rocky peak. The butcher, who everyone calls Baloney because it is the saddest of all meats, he would sing and cry, and he has a daughter who, you know, has one leg, one arm, is blind due to cataracts, and his wife died in a tragic accident. And if you can believe it, the story goes downhill from there. And I think that you're right. I mean, it is a deceptively simple story. I mean, it's one of those life's a bitch and then you die type stories. But I think they take it, you know, the author Blanchett takes it one step further, where it's life's a bitch. You get a glimmer of hope that, wait, things could get better. And then the carpet gets ripped out from under you. You know, you realize, oh, wait, I thought I had it bad. Oh, no, it gets worse. And I think that's what kept coming back to me. And like you said, filling in all those blanks, how horrible and miserable their life and existence must be. The part about the daughter wanting to go to school and the father realizing she couldn't go to school because she was blind and had one leg and one arm. So they send off for a tutor for her. That's his Christmas or his birthday present to her. When she's 20, he sends for a tutor. And then the next page, it talks about now she's 25, and you're realizing in your head, wait a minute, 5 years have passed, and still no tutor. And your mind, you're right, it just keeps filling in those blanks. How miserable must it be? You're full of excitement, you send off for the tutor, and you realize, okay, it'll take a week for them to get the letter. And then some time to deliberate, and then some time to return you a response.
Yeah.
And then after that time, well, then you start to feel, well, maybe it was snowing on the way.
Yeah.
We'll add a week. Well, maybe it arrived at the end of terms. We'll add a month. How can you keep telling yourself that for 5 years? I mean, just what a miserable, miserable time that this thing that should have been so wonderful must have been so horrible.
To me, this book is everything that's good about indie comics. It really pushes the boundaries, I think, in the artistic style, the prose, everything about it. It, to me, was just, it blew me away.
The art, for me, I had a real love-hate relationship with. On the one hand, I thought the art for this book was absolutely perfect. I thought it was wonderful. I thought it added, an overbearing presence when one was needed, and a hint of levity when it was called for. I thought that the introduction of the tutor was fantastic. When you see him, you know, the stranger across the square, suitcase in hand, floating above the ground like a ghost. And I just love that image of him floating across the town square. But there were parts where I felt like the art was almost a little, I don't know, over the top, and I don't know, almost pretentious in some places, where it was just kind of like too cute, you know, too much, too artsy. I don't know.
I don't know. I didn't feel that way at all. I loved every single page, and I found myself coming back and not even reading the story, just looking at the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
and really seeing how it relates to the prose that's on the other page, because usually there's one page of art and then one page of prose, mm-hmm. and the art just blew me away. This is really what I mm-hmm. the art style that I like and I okay. enjoy. So I felt like it was perfect, and this was like the best $16-$17 that I've spent on comics in a while, and I am really gonna look at Drawn and Quarterly again and probably pick up White Rapids.
Yeah, I thought I agree. I mean, that there were some real pitch perfect moments on this that you just don't get in another comic. I mean, the point really for me, my favorite character was the tutor, and I don't know if that's because I'm a teacher or because, for me, not having read that this was a Russian fatalist piece until after I was done, he's the glimmer of hope that comes in. The part where his curiosity grew into obsession so that some days the weight of his thoughts brought him down to earth. I thought that was just such a wonderful moment.
Yeah.
That you're right. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I really look for in a book. That's the image for me that keeps coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Little pieces like that.
It seemed also that he was setting it up to be like an opera. It's very sparse in the prose,
mm-hmm.
and you just get this wonderful visual sense, and then you have the music to go along with it, and it's sort of like you're an audience to this performance,
mm-hmm.
instead of going through and reading it. And it's an incredibly fast read if you just go straight through it. I mean, I think it would take you maybe a half hour,
mm-hmm.
just straight through it, but because of the beauty of the art and just trying to look at how the prose and the art fit together so well, I think that really made this a wonderful experience for me.
Right, and you know, again, for people that haven't seen it, it's done in a real 1920s, 30s Art Deco style, so everything is plain and shapes to belie size of things and curves to make movement, which again, for something that's done in black, white, and red, and again with large blocky shapes, there was a real sense of movement to this as well, that you really could see the characters acting and behaving and moving and doing, and there wasn't any real stiffness in characters that they were in art that you sometimes see.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for something that's made up of angles and straight lines in, you know, in places that, you know, and really simple drawings of characters, it was nice to see that. I think that really, you know, this is one that I would recommend to people to seek out and find. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I would say, go to your local comic shop and ask for it.
Yeah.
You know, go to Amazon. It should be on Amazon in a couple of weeks. Find it. Go out. Because I think you're right. This is an independent experience. This is never something that Marvel's going to publish. This is never something that DC is going to publish. None of the big companies would ever publish a book comparable to this.
Beyond that, I think it's even something different out of the big three indie publishers, you know, like Dark Horse, Image, and Vertigo. I don't think I would ever see a book like this. I'm going to look on Drawn and Quarterly and see what else they have out there, because they've really caught my eye.
Right. Yeah, this was definitely an impressive, impressive piece. And I hope that it gets the kind of attention it deserves, because really this was the kind of book that not just belongs in a comic book collection, but belongs on your coffee table, belongs in the living room for a casual observer, someone who you would never think to hand a comic book to. Mm-hmm. This belongs in the kind of place where someone can stumble on it and really sit down and see the possibilities of the medium.
Mm-hmm.
So Terry Moore's Echo. It's a very different book than Bologna.
Mm-hmm.
Coming to us from Abstract Studios, which is Terry Moore's his own imprint, his own studio that he set up when he was doing Strangers in Paradise. And you were telling me you haven't read Strangers in Paradise.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is more or less your first introduction to Terry Moore.
Yep.
So I'm curious, what do you think? Because for me, I'm coming to this with almost 15 years of Terry Moore under my belt. I'm a big fan of Strangers in Paradise. I have the whole collection. So for me, I'm having one experience with this. I'm curious to what you are coming from.
This was a fun story, and I enjoyed it, but my problem is that, unlike Bologna, there's no boundaries that are being pushed here. This is like an action movie, you know, and I feel like if I want that kind of an experience, I can get that from Marvel or DC and go get an action experience. I don't go to see an independent film to watch Die Hard. That being said, I did really enjoy it. I don't think that I'm probably going to pick up the second trade because it was $16. It was a dollar less than Bologna, and I felt like I didn't get even anywhere close to the same experience that I got with Bologna.
See, and I'm gonna respectfully disagree with you on a couple of the points about, you know, I agree with you, this was like a big action flick, and I kind of see this as sort of the independent alternative to it. There are times where I really enjoy a good independent action flick. I mean, something like, you know, Leon the Professional or the original La Femme Nikita, which were, you know, independent or foreign films that are far superior to what we get in our Hollywood studio system. And granted, they're few and far between. And when I'm looking for just a popcorn flick, you're right, I'll go and see, you know, Die Hard or, you know, Indiana Jones 8 or whatever it is. What I enjoyed about this was that for an action flick, and this is, again, coming from my experience with Terry Moore, is that I find his characters to be engrossing. I find his characters to be a little more well-rounded. Some of them were in this were a little one-sided, and I think the reason was is that in six issues, he has introduced, I mean, I lost count of the number of characters he introduced in this book. I think his main characters were really interesting and, you know, people that either I could relate to, despite the gender difference, or were people that I want to know more about. I mean, his main character, Julie Martin, the way how she is introduced and then the little bits of her that we get revealed along the way. She goes back home, the answering machine's playing messages. The first one's from her sister, who is telling her to come over and wine and cheese, and the kids are out with the husband. And the second message is from her, you know, her, we find out, fiance, who is, or I'm sorry, not fiance, husband, you know, asking for the divorce papers. As we get little bits, and then we learn more about how, you know, there's no food in the fridge, and we learn more that all of a sudden the water's, you know, the heat's turned off. We learn more that the sister is in a private mental institution because she's had a breakdown because her husband and kids were killed in some sort of accident. It's that kind of revealing of a character that I really liked about this that I don't think would happen in a you know, mainstream Marvel DC type superhero comic.
But I mean, you already know the characters in those comics.
Right.
And that was wonderfully done for like a first, I thought it was five issues, isn't it?
Maybe it's five, eight, could be.
I thought that was wonderfully done. Like the way he introduces the characters and reveals, you know, their personalities was really well done. And I'm not saying that this isn't like a well-crafted book and that it isn't enjoyable, because I thoroughly enjoyed the story and it does leave me wanting to know what's going to happen next. I just felt for $16 and you're getting five issues. I mean, that's $3 an issue. And then you're paying a dollar for like the two pages of drawings in the back. And I just didn't feel like that was a great deal. And I didn't feel like maybe this was something that I would pull down again, you know, like Ex Machina, where I want to reread it. And not only beyond that, I feel like a good trade really needs to have a distinct ending. Mm-hmm. And this one doesn't. It's just an introduction, again, like Young Liars was
right
last week. But whereas Young Liars, actually, the characters weren't likable, and it was this whole feeling of, how is he going to pull this off with the characters being completely unlikable, and you don't really empathize with any of them except for Donnie. So I guess that's where I find the difference.
I can see that. I mean, and I agree with you. When I read that ending, the first thought I had was, Thor's going to hate this. Thor's going to hate this ending because it ends with Julie and the park ranger guy, whose name escapes me, riding off to Arizona or someplace in the Southwest with a biker gang to hide out. And that was the part that really felt flushed, you know, I'm sorry, it felt rushed for me. The part, you know, I was telling you that for the most part, it felt like everyone was really well fleshed out. I thought that the park ranger and the biker gang element was just sort of thrown in and came out of nowhere. I appreciated the interaction between the park ranger and the bartender when we're first introduced to the bartender.
Who is it? The leader of the biker gang?
Who's the leader of the biker gang? I appreciated that interaction. I thought that was great, how they were kind of sizing each other up, and then they find out they're both ex-military, and there's that camaraderie and brotherhood there. But to jump from that to all of a sudden, the ex-military guy is going to volunteer his biker gang and give him a couple $1,000 to get out of town and hide the truck, that was a leap where everything else had been so carefully laid out and so painstakingly slowly revealed. To have it just jump like that felt like, you know, Terry Moore had the next place he wanted to go and
didn't want to take the time to plot it out.
Right, didn't want, exactly. Which, you know, which was frustrating because I felt like everything else in this plotted out and paced so well. And you know, I think my favorite character out of all of this has got to be Ivy. Ivy, the woman who was brought in by the military. Well, it's not really the military, by the nuclear research lab. To track down Julie, and just the way her character is revealed is fantastic. Revealed almost entirely through her direct dialogue.
The great thing about her is that she's kind of the antagonist in this story, yet you empathize with her and almost want her to succeed as much as you want the protagonist.
Right.
Because they make her a real human being instead of just, you know, Dr. Doom.
Well, yeah, and I mean, just talk about heartbreaking. I mean, as Ivy flies away and her little daughter is standing there with the nanny saying, "Bye, Mommy." I mean, that was a really... I mean, you're right. I mean, for an antagonist, that was a hard scene to watch.
Yeah.
Because you on the one hand, you don't want to like her because she's tracking, you know, she's tracking down and hunting down the protagonist. But on the other hand, you know, she's a mother who is always going away from her daughter to go do horrible things to people.
And she's very intelligent and perceptive. I mean, the scene where she just sits in the protagonist's truck.
Right.
And immediately knows like 10 things about her, you know, right off the bat. And the guy's like, "What are you, psychic?" And she just goes, "No, I looked in her glove box and there was blah, blah, blah. And I saw the candy wrappers. So, you know, that infers this." And I thought that was really well done.
Yeah. And the whole dog, you know, if she has dog hair everywhere, if the dog rides with her, then, she, you know, the dog probably sleeps in the bed. And yeah, I agree. And that's the kind
of... I bought into all of that. I felt like all of that was reasonable.
And that's the kind of dialogue I was talking about that reveals her character so much more than having two people talk about her and then she enters the room, which is, you know, the easy shortcut way that so many authors take. And I thought that...
And the reveal of it, too, where she just says, "This is the way she is. This is the way she is." You know, she just goes down a list. And the guys, and you as a reader, are thinking like, "Whoa, how's that possible? You know, she must be psychic or something." And then the reveal that, you know, she is just incredibly perceptive and good at what she does. That was fantastic. While, you know, revealing the characterization of our protagonist.
Right. You know, talk about revealing. I think that there's some real praise that should go to you know, Terry Moore in his art, in that he didn't take the really cheap way out of this, in that for a woman who ends up getting basically a titanium bra out of the deal, there's no nudity in this.
Mm-hmm.
And he has characters dressing and undressing, and it's not done in a cheesecake manner.
No, it's tasteful. That was one thing that when I reread it,
mm-hmm.
I picked up on as well. Like, just how well, even though she's basically nude and like, or half nude, topless,
mm-hmm.
in multiple scenes, but I never felt like it was just, you know, for fanboy, that chick's hot.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine this in the hands of a Mike Deodato or in the hands of a Greg Land, or, I mean, it would have been all tits and ass through the whole thing. And I really felt like he showed enough that you felt like you were looking in on someone who was real, but without it being arousing.
Voyeuristic.
Exactly. There was a reality part of it that, yes, people do have to, you know, go to the bathroom. And if you live with you and your dog, you're probably going to pee with the door open.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't done in a trashy or voyeuristic way.
Yeah. That being said, though, everybody in this book is attractive.
The art style in this, I mean, Terry Moore has a very distinctive art style. And again, you know, coming from Strangers in Paradise, it really looks like this is, I mean, artistically speaking, the next volume in the Strangers in Paradise series. There are some artists who over time, their art really evolves, and his doesn't. And you're right. I mean, all the women are very attractive in this. He does a much better job mixing it up with the men characters. He's able to have fat men and thin men and tall men and short men and comedic men. He's always, you know, in all of his books, he has the funny little characters who, you know, when we're introduced to the ex-husband who works at, I don't know, a tire company or something, he's being harassed by a little man who's saying that he doesn't have any brakes. And you know, Terry Moore's always got these little comedic characters in there.
Mm-hmm.
Or he'll play a very angry scene over the top and comically, almost, I mean, not artistically, you know, like manga in the you know, shape of the drawing, but in the way the action's portrayed. Sometimes in manga you get a, you know, a character all of a sudden becoming very cartoony to show how angry they are. And he'll kind of push it that way a little bit. But I never felt like that detracted from the book at all. I thought it was just the ridiculousness of some of these people in the situations.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many characters introduced in these five issues, probably. So many characters that are introduced. I was glad I had this in trade form, because I found myself going back to make sure I had everybody sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get, you know, we get the main character, Julie, we get Ivy, who is the kind of the antagonist, or if she isn't the antagonist, she's the Boba Fett, the bounty hunter in this. We get several of these, you know, quasi-military nuclear research people. We get the military actually involved. We've got the park ranger involved. We've got the ex-husband involved. We've got the biker gang involved. He's introduced so many people that it becomes almost a matter of having a checklist of figuring out who all is who and where they fit in this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, with the female characters having a little more delineation between the female characters would have been a little more helpful for me.
Yeah, I felt like really the only thing different between Ivy and the main character is that the main character's hair's a little bit blonder and Ivy had a barrette in her hair.
Right.
Oh, and the chrome bra.
And the chrome bra. But, yeah, you know, for me, like I said, I mean, I think for any dyed-in-the-wool Strangers in Paradise fan, this is what we were hoping for. I mean, honestly, this is what we were hoping for. We were hoping for a not necessarily a continuation of the story of Francine and Kachu, who are the main characters in Strangers in Paradise, but we were looking for, you know, well-rounded, quality characters who were put in a situation where there was tension and action and interaction between people, which is his real strength. I mean, I don't think that anybody... I think that when most Strangers in Paradise fans found out that he was going to be doing sort of a science fiction adventure story, you know, I know I got a little nervous about it, just because, you know, he spent the last 15 years basically doing a character drama. And yes, there was action. I mean, the Parker girls are just a bunch of brutal killers in Strangers in Paradise. But it plays out much the same way this does, where the violence, the action is a small part of a much larger character drama. So having the science fiction element of this, of the titanium bra with the, you know, powers, and now she has some, that was the other thing, the somehow connection to the previous wearer. Mm-hmm. That adds just another element that will be interesting to see how he includes it into this character drama, because it doesn't read like a science fiction piece necessarily.
Definitely not. I mean, it's definitely deeper than that.
Right.
I just found it, I guess, a little bit lacking in... I was just hoping for a little bit more pushing the boundaries, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel like that's what this was about. Which is fine. I mean, that's perfectly fine for somebody to want that and to want to read that. Like I said, I found it enjoyable, and it was certainly a fun read.
Right.
I just don't know if I can drop another $16 on the next trade.
And see, for me, it's, you know, you had brought up Ex Machina. For me, this kind of goes in the same category of, you know, Ex Machina is a superhero story that I want to read and that I really look forward to and that I wish that other superhero stories would aspire to be. Mm-hmm. And for me, Echo is the same kind of deal, where it definitely falls in that sort of superhero genre type deal, where I wish that more superhero books would move towards this direction, where the heroics were a part of it, but there was so much more character development. But, you know, there was a recent Hulk arc where, you know, for issue on issue, you know, the Hulk really didn't show up. And it was all Bruce Banner on the run and Bruce Banner trying to deal with the demon within him. And it really focused so much more on characters than Hulk smash.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the kind of thing that really pushed that book for a long time, was a development of characters over action. And I think for this, where it did kind of fall apart was in the action scenes, where they were running away, where they were getting shot at, where they were getting chased. And I think that sticking to the character development with a science fiction framework, if you will, is the strength of this.
Sure. And I'll probably borrow yours when you buy it.
You're welcome to, and I'll set you up with 15 years of Strangers in Paradise to wade through. What do you think about the homeless guy?
Oh, that's the other guy that was down by Moon Lake, right? So he's ultimately going to be the antagonist in the story, as I see it.
You see it as that?
Sort of like the Hulk versus the Abomination kind of thing. That's the way I assume where he's going with it. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I can't figure out where to place him in all of this, to tell you the truth. Because he does some pretty grotesque stuff. I mean... There's a page in here that is worthy of a Garth Ennis script, you know, after what this homeless guy does. But it almost seems like, because he runs into the main character at the hospital, and I don't see him as necessarily being bad to her. So I don't know what the connection is. He's a character that I want to know how he fits into this larger picture as well. I mean, I can figure out kind of, you know, like you said, the protagonist, the antagonist, the love interest, you know, I can see where some of these characters fit in, but the homeless guy who was down at the lake, I really don't know where he comes into all of this. And he's going to be one that I'm looking forward to watching and figuring out where he comes in. But I was going to say, if people are interested in continuing the conversation or following up or commenting on anything we've said, to stop by the blog or to visit our MySpace page and leave a comment, and let's continue the conversation.
And where are those at?
StumptownTradeReview.blogspot.com and MySpace.com/StumptownTrade.